Turn again then please to the book of Hosea. As I said, we're going to begin a series in this prophecy, and we're looking this morning at the passage we read, chapter 1 verse 1 to chapter 2 verse 1. The opening verse of Hosea mentions two different nations, Judah and Israel. If you know your Old Testament history, you'll know that these were originally one nation. It was one nation that came out of Egypt in the Exodus. It was one nation that entered and settled in the Promised Land. It was one nation that was led for several centuries by a series of judges. It was one nation that asked for and was given a king, King Saul. It was one nation that was subsequently ruled by King David and by King Solomon. But then, it was after that that you remember a seismic change took place. There was a tragic split. In that one nation, it became two nations, Israel in the north and Judah in the south, each with its own capital, Samaria and Jerusalem, respectively, and each with its own kings. And Hosea then, he lived and ministered a long time after that split, and his focus is on Israel. That's never explicitly stated, but it's obvious. Israel is mentioned by name 44 times. Ephraim, another name for Israel, is mentioned a further 37 times. Judah, on the other hand, is only mentioned 15 times. And many of the there are many towns and villages mentioned in this book, and almost always those towns and villages are in Israel rather than in Judah. But although Hosea then is a prophet to the northern kingdom specifically, he's not sectarian. Judah may not be the people to whom God has called Hosea to minister, but Judah, in Hosea's outlook, is not Sunderland. It's not the other lot further south that we don't like. Not at all. No, for one thing, he desires and looks forward to a reintegration of Israel and Judah. There'll be a touch of that comes across in this morning's passage. And by the way, let's just pause there, and it's worth asking, I think, what that spirit that we see in Hosea looks like translated into our context. Hosea desired this reintegration of Judah and Israel. He wasn't sectarian in his outlook. And at the very least then, surely, translating that into our context, it means ridding ourselves of any snootiness and any smugness and any suspicion and any superciliousness toward other branches of Christ's church. It means being interested in and warmly disposed towards all who worship the same God that we do and believe in the same gospel that we do, whatever other differences there may be between us. Wasn't it wonderful on Wednesday morning, amidst our sadness, to be a congregation drawn from Presbyterian churches, Baptist churches, Anglican churches, charismatic churches, all singing together of our joint hope in the Lord Jesus Christ? But occasions like that can easily be like the Christmas truce in World War I, when the opposing soldiers for a few hours talked and laughed and played football together before then returning to their trenches and resuming combat. Let's be Hoseas who don't like the high dividing walls that sadly often exist within the people of God. So I'm saying Hosea then, he's not sectarian. For one thing, he desires and looks forward to reintegration. But then for another thing, he has a clear understanding that at the center of God's purposes is Judah's monarchy. Not Israel's soap opera of a monarchy, with its numerous short-lived dynasties, each one ending in the chaos of treacherous plots and brutal assassinations. He doesn't look at all of that with kind of rose-tinted glasses on because he's from Israel. No, Judah's monarchy, with its successive generations of David's descendants on the throne. Hosea understands that that's where the hope of the world lies. And he looks ahead, chapter 3, verse 5, to a great King David reigning in the latter days. He means a great king from David's line. And it's probably why then here in the opening verse, he mentions these four kings of Judah in his own day. Not because their reigns have any major impact on the people in the north to whom Hosea is ministering, but just because he has this high view of Judah's monarchy, running through Uzziah and Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah, he sees a precious genealogical thread that is going to culminate in the king who will save the world. So Hosea then, I'm saying he's this northern but non-sectarian prophet. And as his ministry gets going, here in our passage this morning, let's notice three things. First of all, a drama that's unexpected. A drama that's unexpected. And I mean drama in the stronger sense of that word. If you say to me when we're chatting over coffee later, Dan, we had a right drama before church this morning, what you mean is that you came downstairs and discovered that your dog had vomited all night all over the kitchen floor, or that you left your house to come to church and reversed straight into your neighbor's new sports car, or that you split your trousers bending down to pick up your Bible and had to hastily don a different pair. That's the kind of thing that you mean by a drama. You don't mean that the Royal Shakespeare Company turned up at your house this morning and put on a performance of King Lear. You're using the word drama in its looser sense. Now, at the beginning of verse 3, Hosea gets married. And it's a drama, this marriage. But there, I'm not using the word in its looser sense. I'm not saying the marriage is a drama because the best man manages to lose the ring or something, or because someone accidentally sits on the wedding cake, because Hosea's great auntie Mildred drinks too much at the reception and makes a fool of herself. No, I'm saying the marriage is literally a drama. It's literally a drama. It's a drama in the theatrical sense. Not that Hosea's marriage is unreal. We mustn't think that. Hosea and Gomer do genuinely become a husband and wife. But the marriage is a drama in that it's a public spectacle in which people are meant to see something else being represented. As Hannah and I many years ago sat in London's Globe Theatre, we weren't meant to look at that scene in front of us and think, ah, there's Mark Rylance walking along a bit of wooden stage in a funny circular building on the south bank of the Thames. That is, in fact, what we were looking at. But we were meant to see through that and think, ah, that's Hamlet on the ramparts of the Royal Castle in Denmark. That's how drama works, isn't it? And that's how this marriage between Hosea and Gomer works. As I say, it's a real marriage, but it's a marriage that God arranges in order to portray, to dramatize, to act out something that he wants to get across to the people of Israel. It's not the only time God chooses this method of getting a point across. You remember how it says in the New Testament letter of Hebrews, chapter 1, verse 1, long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. And it really was in many ways. The prophet Jeremiah had to hide his underwear near the river Euphrates until it rotted, Jeremiah 13, 1 to 7. Because God wanted to get a certain point across. The prophet Isaiah had to walk around naked and barefoot for 3 years. Isaiah 20, verses 2 and 3. The prophet Ezekiel had to lie on his side for well over a year, at the same time baking bread on a fire using human excrement as fuel, Ezekiel chapter 4. Although when he complained, God did allow him to use cow dung as fuel instead. And hearing of those other dramas then that God put on during Old Testament times, you might think that Hosea actually gets off quite lightly. He doesn't have to bury his underwear. He doesn't have to go around in public without any clothes on. He doesn't have to lie on his side and construct a stinky fire each day. He can find a wife and settle down to a life of domestic bliss. No bizarre antics are required of him. He was probably going to get married anyway, wasn't he? So it isn't a big deal for him to have to do so within the context of this drama that God is putting on. But if you think that, you're wrong. Very wrong. Actually, it's those other prophets that got off lightly. Because look at what the divine stage director says to his leading actor in verse 2. Go, Hosea, and marry that lovely, godly Israelite girl on whom you've had a crush and you've been plucking up courage for 6 months to ask her on a date. Go and marry her, Hosea. No, No. Go, take to yourself a wife of whoredom. That's what you're to do, Hosea. Whoredom is not a word that is really part of our modern vocabulary, and perhaps obscures, therefore, just how shocking God's command here is. The phrase is literally in the Hebrew, a wife of prostitutions. Go take to yourself a wife of prostitutions. Now, there is in Hebrew a straightforward word for a prostitute, and it's used sometimes in the Old Testament. Here, it's not used. And you might think, well, at least that's something then. At least Hosea isn't being told to marry an actual prostitute. That really would be the pits. But I'm not sure that this is preferable. Then, as now, you didn't become a prostitute as a career choice. You became a prostitute either because you were so destitute it was the only way of avoiding starvation, or because you were in the clutches of some Jeffrey Epstein type of character who was forcing you to do it. But you see, Hosea is to marry a woman who is as promiscuous as a prostitute, even though she's not actually one. She's not some poor soul being paid for sex because it's her only lifeline, but a woman who brazenly chooses to have lots of partners without being paid anything for it. That, I think, is the significance of her being called a woman of prostitutions rather than a straightforward prostitute. And if anything, then it's worse, I'm saying. And I hope you can see why my heading was a drama that's unexpected. I mean, those other dramas involving Old Testament prophets that I touched on, they're pretty unexpected, but this one, it's unexpected on a whole different level. You think of all that material in the book of Proverbs. A father telling his son not to get caught up with a loose woman. We don't know anything, do we, about this man Beeri, who's mentioned in verse 1, Hosea's father. But if there was any godliness in him, he'd probably kept a close eye on his son as Hosea grew up during his adolescent years, making sure Hosea wasn't showing any romantic interest in the wrong sort of girls. Occasionally, perhaps having a word with Hosea. You make sure, son, that you're wise and discerning when thinking about marriage prospects. Make sure you go for someone like Mrs. Beeri, a good woman who takes the law of God seriously. It's really important, Hosea. You need to get this right. Marry in haste, repent at leisure. That's the kind of instruction that Beeri perhaps gave to his son over the years of his childhood and adolescence. Perhaps he often prayed as well that his son would marry wisely and well. And then one day God comes along. And in a single sentence, God overthrows all those years of careful parental training. Go, take to yourself, Hosea, a wife of prostitutions. And there's a moment then when Hosea has to break the news to his father. Dad, I'm getting married. I'm marrying Gomer. And Beeri looks at him blankly. Gomer? I don't know this girl. The only Gomer I've heard of around these parts is Diblaim's daughter, and it's obviously not her. She's not, marriage material. And Hosea replies, no, Dad, it's that Gomer. It's that Gomer that I'm going to marry. What's going on here? Why is God arranging this shocking drama? What can he possibly want to portray to Israel that needs Hosea to marry Gomer in order to portray it? Well, look at the last part of verse 2. So go take to yourself a wife of prostitutions and have children of prostitutions, for the land commits great prostitutions by forsaking Yahweh. As Hannah and I watched Mark Rylance on the Globe stage, we saw Hamlet. And as the Israelites watched Hosea seeking to be a husband, a genuine husband, to a woman with constantly wandering eyes and an irrepressible addiction to other men's beds, they were meant to see Yahweh. And in that woman, with her constantly wandering eyes and her addiction to other men's beds, they were meant to see themselves. Because you see, Yahweh and Israel were in a covenant relationship, an exclusive covenant relationship, like a marriage. But of course, in that ancient Near Eastern environment in which Israel lived, it was full of gods, all the different gods that the different nations worshipped. And in Hosea's day, Israel was finding the pull of those exotic foreign gods very, very strong. Stronger indeed than the pull of her covenant bond to Yahweh. And the Israelites engaged frequently, as will emerge in this book, in the worship and in the rites that were connected with those foreign gods. And Yahweh then wants Israel to see clearly what this is, what it amounts to, what's going on here. He wants them to see that in their engagement with those other gods, they aren't just adding a little more bread and spice to their religious diet. No, they are Gomer. They are a disgraceful bride, ripping up by their behavior the covenant that they are bound by. He wants the Israelites to watch this solemn, tragic, almost unbelievable drama unfolding before their eyes, there in the city of Samaria, or wherever exactly it is that Hosea and Gomer live. And watching the drama, he wants the wretchedness of their own idolatry, which just described in words, they might easily shrug off. He wants the wretchedness of their idolatry to hit them with devastating force. A drama that's unexpected. Secondly, this morning, a divorce that's unavoidable. A divorce that's unavoidable. So Hosea isn't just to marry Gomer, he's also to have children. I read it just then, verse 2. Go take to yourself a wife of prostitutions and have children of prostitutions. Some people think that this means these children won't actually be Hosea's own. They'll be conceived as Gomer sleeps around with other men. But I don't think that's what's intended. The language of verse 3 sounds very much like the first child, at least, is biologically Hosea's. I think the phrase means something else. Hosea's kids are going to be children of prostitutions, in the sense that they're going to be damaged by their mother's lifestyle. They won't be unaffected and unscarred by it. Perhaps indeed their mother's lifestyle will actually be replicated in them as they grow up. Despite no doubt Hosea's best efforts, they will inherit her moral framework, her promiscuous propensities. They will go down the same depressing route that she has normalized for them over the years that they've been living with her. It fits the idea of the drama that we've just been talking about in our first point. Because you see, Israel's infidelity to Yahweh, it was something that tended to get passed on from generation to generation. A tragic perversion of how life in the people of God was supposed to work. We sang just now in Psalm 78 about how it was supposed to work. Israelite children should have been, as it were, drinking in with their mother's milk the truth about Yahweh and all his redemptive acts. But instead, they were drinking in lies about Baal, and having their hearts horribly poisoned from infancy. And so when in Hosea's family then, infidelity was passed on from Gomer to the children, again, it was kind of dramatizing, I think, what was going on in wider society where that higher sort of infidelity was being passed on from one generation to another. But the other thing about Hosea's children, apart from that description of them there in verse 2, the other striking thing, of course, about them is the names which they are given. When I go places, people will ask sometimes about my family, and I'll tell them that my wife is called Hannah and my children are called Isaac, Talitha, and Fraser. And they'll say, what was the second one? But when Hosea then told people the names of his children, it wouldn't have just been what was the second one, would it? They might have said, can you go through them all again, please? Or at the very least, they'd have said, can you go through those second two again? What did he say their names were? And in my case, then, it, of course, leads often to a nice, pleasant conversation. What was the second one they'll ask? I'll say it slowly this time. Talitha. And they say, oh, right, is that Welsh? And I'll say, no, it's not Welsh, it's Aramaic. Oh, really? That's very exotic. I'll say, yes, it's Aramaic for little girl, because once Jesus, he used that word when he was raising a little girl back to life who was dead. And if they're Christians, then the penny will suddenly drop. Ah, yes, of course, what a lovely name. Hosea didn't have nice, pleasant conversations like that. Okay, he would have said to the person looking baffled at his children's strange names. Okay, you ready for this then? My elder son is called Jezreel because of the place Jezreel, where Yahweh is soon going to subject Israel to a crushing military defeat that will wipe them out as a nation. And my daughter is called No Mercy because Yahweh is soon going to run out of mercy for Israel. And my younger son is called Not My People because Yahweh is disowning the people of Israel. So there you go, you did ask. And remember again then that Hosea's marriage to Gomer, we said, is representative. It points beyond itself to something else. It's saying that marriage of Hosea to Gomer, it's saying that Yahweh, like Hosea, is lumbered with a perfidious bride. Well, if that's what Hosea's marriage is saying, then what Hosea's children's names are saying is this. Divorce is unavoidable. Divorce is unavoidable. Yahweh must do the obvious, reasonable, inevitable thing. He must punish Israel. That's the significance of the name Jezreel. In the valley of Jezreel, Israel is going to be subjugated to the Assyrians, who will carry her off into exile. Thus, verse 4, putting an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. Not only that, Yahweh must empty himself of mercy toward Israel. That's the significance of the name No Mercy, verse 6. And not only that, Yahweh must utterly dissociate himself from Israel. That's the significance of the name Not My People, verse 9. These names then, they make the situation absolutely crystal clear. The relationship's over. Israel's flouting of the covenant in her dalliances with Baal has sunk the marriage. It's finished. It's irremediable. The repeatedly jilted Yahweh is calling time on it. The bond just isn't tenable. It isn't sustainable anymore when one of its parties holds it in such little regard. Perhaps the Israelites generally, when they heard about the names of Hosea's children, perhaps they laughed, perhaps they rolled their eyes. Oh, that prophet's choice of names is terrible, isn't it? Was he drunk or something when he opted for those? But in actual fact, those names, they didn't testify to their father's eccentricity. They testified to something way, way more momentous. They testified to Yahweh's disavowal of his bride, his repudiation of his bride, his casting off of his bride, a divorce that's unavoidable. So a drama that's unexpected, a divorce that's unavoidable. But then thirdly and finally this morning, a defiance that's unleashed. A defiance that's unleashed. Now, defiance is a word that we often use in a negative way. If you're a parent and your toddler defies you, then that's a bad thing. The toddler needs a smack bottom. And if I were to tell you then that I think the supreme theme of the book of Hosea is defiance, and I do, your reaction would probably be, yeah, we know exactly what you mean, Dan. Hosea is all about how Israel has defied God and must now face the consequences. But that's not what I mean. Certainly that is a prominent theme, and we've already encountered it in these opening verses, but I think that defiance is not actually the supreme theme. I think a different defiance is. Not a negative defiance, but actually a wonderfully positive defiance. Not Israel's defiance, but God's defiance. That, I think, is the supreme theme, actually, of the book of Hosea. And perhaps you say, well, what on earth is that? What is God's defiance? Well, it's this. In the book of Hosea, just when it seems there's nothing else for it, divine judgment must be poured out of the most irreversible and terminal kind. Just at that point, it's as if God says, wait a minute, no, I'm not going to let Israel's sin have the last word. I'm not going to let Israel's sin be the decisive factor on which everything turns. No way. That's the kind of defiance I'm talking about. You get moments like that in this book. We actually went to one last Sunday morning, some of you may dimly remember. And you get one here in the last part of our passage from verse 10 onwards. Remember our second point. Remember how with the giving of these names to his children in verses 4 to 9, with Hosea giving those names, it seems like the relationship between Yahweh and Israel is over. Things could not be bleaker. They could not be more hopeless than they are. And it's at that point, that nadir, where Yahweh seems to have the pen in his hand and he's signing the divorce papers, that suddenly his defiance is unleashed and he puts the lid firmly back on the pen and he tosses it over his shoulder. Because in these verses, these final verses of our passage, it's announced that the things signified in all three of those names of Hosea's children, the things signified in all three of those names are going to be reversed. Jezreel, the name signified defeat to Assyria and exile and the consequent end of Israel as a nation in its own land. All of that is going to be reversed. The end of verse 11, they shall go up from the land. That must be the land of their exile. And indeed, there's a play, I think, on the word Jezreel there at the end of verse 11. Jezreel, earlier in the passage, is the place where Israel is going to be subjugated. But the word Jezreel, it actually means something like God sows. And there's going to be that sort of Jezreel. God is going to replant Israel in its own land. Not mercy. Not mercy signified the cessation of God's mercy toward Israel. That's going to be reversed. People are going to excitedly say to each other, chapter 2, verse 1, you have received mercy. Not my people. That name signified Yahweh severing his connection with Israel. That's going to be reversed. Second half of verse 10, in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, it shall be said to them, children of the living God. And you see what I mean then about God's defiance, this wonderful positive defiance that I've described to you. God's defiance being, as it were, unleashed in these last verses of our passage. There's almost an indignant spirit in God here. Why should my plans and purposes to bless my people, my plans and purposes expressed in promises centuries ago, notice the first half of verse 10 is an allusion to his promise to Abraham about descendants numbering the sand of the sea, on the seashore. Why should my plans and purposes to bless my people have to give way to Israel's sin and idol lust? Why should Israel's sin and idol lust win the day and get the better of my gracious agenda? That ain't going to happen. My plans and purposes, they're going to win the day. My desire to bless my people, that's going to win the day. There's that kind of defiant indignation in God here in these verses. And in that connection, then, just two closing considerations. First of all, this divine defiance, it's actually even better than it initially seems. It's even better than it initially seems. Let's just ask the question, when is this reversal going to take place that is being talked about here? Well, notice verse 11 talks about the children of Judah and the children of Israel being gathered together. And when then Judah returned home after the Babylonian exile that you'll all know about, it seems that there was quite a contingent of the old northern kingdom of Israel that was also caught up in that return to Judah. So Derek Kidner, in his commentary, he says, after the exile, that's the Babylonian exile, we read of people from Ephraim and Manasseh, 1 Chronicles 9, verse 3, which may be a term for the northern tribes in general, settling in Jerusalem with the men of Judah. So Ezra and his band of pilgrims from Babylon offered 12 bulls for all Israel when they reached Jerusalem, Ezra 8, 35. So at that point then, this defiance that we're seeing God express here, it kind of came good. Israel went up from the land of exile. Israel received mercy. And the words, "You are not my people," were replaced with the words, "Children of the living God." Then, after the Babylonian exile, when you had Israelites joining with the people of Judah and settling in the land of Judah. And all of that's great then. However, the Apostle Paul, he understands the reversal that's foretold in these verses to be much more far-reaching than just that, and to have a much more momentous fulfillment further down the line than the end of the Babylonian exile. So Romans chapter 9, verses 24 to 26, this is what Paul writes. I won't go into the verses prior to that, where it's quite a detailed argument, but he refers to we whom God has called, that's Christians, not from the Jews only, but also from the Gentiles. As indeed he says in Hosea. So Paul is saying that now in the first century when he's writing, there are a lot of Gentile Christians whom God has called. And he's saying this is fulfillment of something that the prophet Hosea said. Where did Hosea say that? Well, then he quotes our passage. Those who were not my people, I will call my people. Her who was not beloved, I will call beloved. In the very place where it was said to them, you are not my people, they will be called sons of the living God. So Paul is saying then, since the day of Pentecost, God has been wonderfully at work amongst the Gentiles. He has been claiming as his own complete pagan outsiders. He's been saying to men and women from races that for centuries have been excluded from God's people, you are now my children. And Paul is saying that's the ultimate fulfillment of Hosea chapter 1. And so there's a sense then in which here in Hosea 1, this defiance of God, as he says to Israel, look, you can pursue your idols. You can wallow in the cesspit of your covenant infidelity. It's not going to knock me off course. It's not going to put a spanner in my works. It's not going to disrupt my plans. I may have to disown you for a while, but I'm going to have you back. But he's saying more than that. He's saying, I'm going to have you back, and I'm going to have a whole load of other people back as well. Gentile pagans, people in the United Kingdom, people in Newcastle. I'm going to have a people from all the nations, all the peoples, all the tribes, all the languages. That's how defiant he is here. That's how strongly he's saying, your sin is not going to stop me, Israel. I'm going to have you back, and I'm going to have a massive people back, even from all the Gentile nations. What a wonderful thing. What a wonderful thing that we this morning in this room a part of this defiance, with a product, the fruit of this defiance that we're talking about this morning. But then the second concluding consideration, I think we can carry over this concept of the defiant God, the God who won't be stymied by sin. I think we can carry that over into our own individual lives, and we can be comforted by it this morning. You think of those last verses of Romans 8 that we all love so much. And he's talking there, isn't he, Paul, about all the things that cannot separate us from the love of God. And he has a whole list of items. And some of the items are very specific, and I'm glad that they feature there. Death, that can't separate us from the love of God. Rulers, by which I think he means satanic, demonic rulers. But then other items in that list are very general, aren't they? And I'm glad that they feature too. things to come. That's quite a general phrase. Anything else in all creation. And I'm glad for those general items because they surely have room in them to include what perhaps is the biggest threat of all to us remaining in the love of God. And that is our own sin, isn't it? Our own tendency to press the self-destruct button. Our own sinful urges and desires. That's the biggest threat of all. What if that separates us from the love of God? And I'm saying Paul has those general phrases then that include that. And that fits then with the end of Hosea chapter 1. And indeed, the book of Hosea as a whole, this theme of God's defiance. He's not going to let anything stop him from fulfilling his gracious purposes toward his people. He's not going to let anything stop him fulfilling his gracious purposes toward you, not even your sin. However powerful that may seem to you sometimes, you may get frightened sometimes how powerful indwelling sin within you is. But he's not going to let that even get in the way of his intention to glorify you along with his son, Jesus Christ. He's a defiant God. His grace always gets the last word, not our sin. That's the message of Hosea. That's the message of this passage, ultimately. No, Israel, your sin's not going to have the last word. My grace is. And that's his message to us as well. And that's his message to you, believer, perhaps struggling this morning with temptation, wondering if you're going to be able to make it to the end of the race, to the finish line. God's grace has the last word, not our sin. We have a wonderfully defiant God. Amen.